Hello, everyone. You're listening to the Paradigm Shifts podcast with your host, Keisha Kruger. I'm an organization development practitioner and executive coach, working with leaders to create positive changes in the workplace using behavioral science. My personal mission? Share science-based tools and leadership insights from the field that you can use in the workplace and beyond. Considering we spend about 3/4 of our lifetime at work, there is incredible science and organizational psychology that could be used to rethink the way we work, lead, and ultimately live. Join me as I speak with thought leaders and business leaders in practice, unpacking light bulb moments for paradigm shifts. Hello, everyone. On this week's episode, we chat about the future of organization development, and we are joined by Alan Landers, who is the president and CEO of the OD and Change Leadership Group. This is a global consulting firm with consultants across the United States and partners in 5 countries. Alan has been an OD practitioner for over 43 years, starting in 1978. Very excited for you to learn more about Alan. Be sure to check out the show notes for information about his services, his company, and how to get in touch with him. Hey, Alan, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Keisha?
Good. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So OD, organization development, it's roughly got its start around the 1930s, but really took off in the 1960s. And since then, there's been some major evolutions and contributions, emerging science to the field. And you, Alan, you bring over 40 years of experience to the world of organization development. So I'm curious, what are some of the top shifts or changes that you've noticed in the field over time?
That's a really good question, and something I've been talking to a lot of people about recently. Most recent development was fostered by two people, Robert Marshak and Jervis Bush, and they started something called Dialogic OD. And it came about maybe about 10, 15 years ago, but it really hasn't hit the ground and gathered a lot of momentum until about maybe a year or two ago, maybe 3 years ago. What happens is there's this type of OD that's called dialogic OD, and it's based upon action research that goes back to the 30s and 40s, what you were talking about. And basically, people would come in and they would do a survey, they'd do a needs analysis, they'd do an organization assessment. And they would, and OD practitioners at the time, people from IO primarily, IO being industrial organizational psych, they were psychometricians. Yeah. And so there was a lot of statistical work. And what they found is that they'd get data, but by the time they started to implement change, things had changed. And so the data was outdated by the time they started to do things.
The standard.
And, there was research done about in the 80s that said, early 80s, that about the original research was maybe 73% of all OD change interventions failed to reach their intended goals. Well, that was it's become a myth. Actually, the real data, somewhere about 50% of the projects failed to reach their goal. And so Jervis and Robert, they started thinking, well, what was the cause of this? What was happening? And the answer was people were taking a statistical, mechanical look at change, and change isn't mechanical.
Yeah.
You can change your mind tomorrow. You can, people change their minds in a whim, chocolate's my favorite food. No, I like vanilla now. Just whatever. And the old processes in OD didn't account for these changes. And so when Jervis and Robert started working, they created this dialogic, which is based upon getting everybody together, talking about what's going, and doing that in an ongoing way.
Right.
So instead of just one time gathering data, it was an ongoing process that involved the whole organization. And they use something called large group interventions, and that could be anywhere between maybe 35, 40 people to 400 people to 1,000 people. I know I was doing an intervention with Isuzu Motors of America, and we had 600 people in the room. And that's kind of what we do. We want to get everybody involved, you know, have a stake, have a say. And I think that's the biggest change. There are some other smaller ones. The emergence of IO psychology is another one. And I have a lot to say about
that. Yeah. So real quick before we go on, so what I'm hearing is action research, that you know, approach to OD, focusing on more of a linear timeline, and it considers change from more of like a data point set or a data set point, and focus groups, interviews, things like that, right? And it doesn't account for the individual factors of change. Not only do we have change in our environment, our society, our community, our businesses, competitive, but also our individual factors that bring change about. And so what I'm hearing is dialogical OD really does take into consideration the humanistic factor of change, and considers that change is ongoing, as you mentioned, and continuous, but it opens up a dialogue between the individuals for that agility to be able to adapt to change in a more agile way. Is that right?
Yeah. Let me, it's not just dialogue, because that sounds like it's just like talking.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But there's a process to it. And at the core are something called generative images. Mm. And so the facilitator, we host interventions. We don't necessarily facilitate. So we create a space that's where people can come and it's safe. And the generative image is basically some sort of word, phrase, image that kind of gets people to thinking outside of what they normally would think. And what we want to do is we want to foster communications around something that isn't but could be. And we want to eliminate all of the restrictions and inhibitions that are existent in organizations so that people can do that. And once you eliminate those, then anything becomes possible. Then you have to sit down and say, well, anything isn't possible. What can we do? And that's where we kind of get into it. So it's not just dialogue and talking, but there's a process that's involved in it as well.
And it seems like that the process and the container that a facilitator holds really supports the evolution of mindsets, which is,
yes,
thinking, changing the way that we think about what we can do rather than just what we do.
Exactly. That mindset change is a big part of dialogic OD.
Thank you for explaining that. And so that's a huge shift. And then you said something else around IO psychology kind of being an emerging shift. Tell me a little bit about that.
Okay. I'll talk about it, but you got to understand I'm kind of this divergent kind of guy. So I'm going to start out talking about something else and then get to it. Back in the day, and the day for me was back in the early 80s, HR did not have a seat at the table. There was no such thing as a CHRO, okay? Chief Human Resources Officer, there wasn't. And so HR was trying like the dickens to, you know, get a voice at the C-level, and they didn't have anybody. So they decided they were going to add training to their thing, okay? But what happened was, about the time that HR was going to add training, IT came along and then invented something called the HR Information System, HRIS, okay? And so people could go online and they could fill out the forms and all that kind of stuff that HR required. And HR said, we need a seat at the table. I mean, IT said, we need a seat at the table, not HR. And there was this clash between them. And so IT said, HR should report to us. And HR said, no, IT should report to us. And of course, you know, that wasn't going to work.
I'm thinking about how that discussion would play out in my organization right now.
Yeah, it's like, well, it was going on back in the early 80s, and IT was coming up with all these different forms and all these different online apps and everything. And so HR's response is, we'll get training, and training will become part of HR. And that worked. And so what happened is HR got a seat at the table, and training lost out. Training totally lost out. We're kind of like underneath whatever, all the different layers. IT got a seat at the table. Okay, so what does that have to do with IO psychology? If you talk to somebody who has a degree in IO psych, you'll find that there are many, many topics from HR to training to talent management to equity, diversity, all that kind of stuff.
Job design, yeah.
Everything. And so as you stop and think about it, how well is one individual going to be able to grasp all of that? And they can't. And so within IO Psych, there people are now specializing. And IO Psych is, if you keep track on LinkedIn, some of the other places, they're trying to get a seat at the table. And they're trying to include everything. And my gripe with that is it doesn't work. It really doesn't work. We need to have specialists. I think psychometrics is a specialty. I think DEI is a specialty. I think change leadership, change is a specialty. And for example, if you think about training, there are certain one of the theories in training, if you're doing instructional design, instructional e-learning, you're creating e-learning, how the eye moves across a screen is something that you learn as an instructional designer. Does an IO psychologist need to know how an eye moves across a computer screen? No. And so I think trying to encompass everything is just working against what we do. I think we need more specialists than we need people.
So you would say that biggest shift as it relates to IO psychology is just around the recognition or realization that specialties need to exist over general type of roles.
I think that what happens is I think people need to be specialists. You're learning to become, or you are a specialist in video. Okay. Now think about it. Is that part of what you learned in your IO curriculum? No, it's something you picked up on your own because this is what you want to do. Okay. And so what happens is you still have that IO background, but now you're supplementing it with other technological skills. And I think that's how people become generalists. I think, you have something that you can do that you're an expert in, and then you add to it, supplement it by gaining other expertise. Like you said at the beginning, I've been doing this I started in OD in 1978. So what is that? 44 years now that I've been doing this. Well, actually 43 now, 45. And over that time, I started out as a trainer. Then I got into OD. Then I got into other technologies, and I'm getting into AI now, artificial intelligence. And so when you've been around that many, years, you have time to kind of develop expertise. But to come out of grad school and think that you can do more than just one or two things, I think that's misleading to students.
So hone in on a specialty and then pick up skills along the way, add them to your toolbox over time, but first specialize.
Right. And I started out as a trainer, okay? And what was good for me at the time was that I had to learn how to do a training needs analysis. And then you ended up having to learn how to do a root cause analysis. Okay, back in the day, as I said earlier, that's where OD was. They were looking at root cause analyses. And so it was the the move from training to OD and the different kinds of analyses, I go, oh, I get it. And so what happened, when you do a training needs analysis, the scope is limited to a particular job or an element of a job. When you're doing an organization assessment, it's a much, much bigger scope. You're looking at a number of jobs across a department, maybe even a division. But that's for me, I started out as a trainer, and eventually I saw similarities between that and OD, and standing in the front of a group and facilitating, as opposed to working with a group of people, a T group, therapy group, and helping people kind of uncover what's going on in them, helping teams work more effectively. So I went from learning theory to group theory to organizational theory. And, you know, of course, over four decades, you kind of get pretty good at some of them.
Yeah, it seems to me like the skills required for the action research approach in an OD practitioner versus the skills required for a dialogic approach would be much different and need to evolve. And so I'm curious, are you also seeing education support that evolution for OD practitioners to upskill in those different areas, such as facilitation, right? That's a huge one for dialogic OD.
Well, we don't. It is a facilitation, but it's a particular type of facilitation. Trainers, when they facilitate, they have a training objective. We're trying to achieve this particular skill set, okay? In OD, when you're doing dialogic OD, you're not quite sure where it's going to end up. Yeah. What you want to do is you want to facilitate a discussion. You want to throw in these kind of images that cause people to think outside of what they normally would and kind of expand their mindsets, as you said. And that's a different type of facilitation. You know, it kind of falls in that genre, but it's a different type.
It seems like it's almost a different type of person, too, in my mind, because if someone who has more of a fixed personality where they want a certain outcome versus someone who's more open to change, that openness to change personality trait, would be maybe more supportive of that type of facilitation and that approach.
And that happens at, I'm going to say, at two different levels. It happens at the consultant level. So you have some consultants. I was talking with a guy the other day who is a psychometrician, and he just thought the idea, well, wouldn't you want to have statistically valid data to support the actions that you're going to take? And you know, how do you argue against that? You say, of course, you know,
yeah.
But there's more to it than that.
Yes.
And he doesn't see more to it than that. And we kind of argued about that and decided that, okay, fine, you have your eye, I have mine. Okay. So the practitioner can have two sides, the one that you cite and then the dialogic, okay? But where the rubber meets the road is the client.
Good.
Because CEOs lean towards the diagnostic side. They want the data. They want the hard data. And so when, as an OD practitioner in the early days, I would go into a client and I'd say, okay, so what's the situation? They'd tell me the situation. I said, okay, well, let me look around, see what we can do and whether I can do anything or not, because it's conceivable that, you know, I can't fix it. And so he said, okay, I'd go look. And then at the end, I would say, okay, you want this. This is as close as I think we can get. And he'd be all happy because this is what he wants, and I was going to get it for him. As a dialogic OD practitioner, I don't know where we're going to end up. You know, because, you know, once we set people free and we, you know, we get rid of all of these, and they can kind of create their own idea of what things should be, that may be a lot different than what the CEO hired me to do in the first place. And for me, that's the biggest struggle, helping them understand that what we may end up with may not be what you expected, but I'm pretty doggone sure that what we end up with will be something everybody in the organization can support and will support, and will get you where you want to go. We're just going to go on track B or track C instead of track A. And if they can buy that, then we're okay.
And also what type of problem you're trying to focus or solve, right? So if it's an innovation problem, perhaps the dialogic OD approach is really important for creating solutions and new possibilities. But if it's a straightforward fix, it might require some more of the diagnostic side. And then the other thing is, does it have to be one or the other? Can it not be this or and that?
Yeah, I am so glad you said that, because that's what went through my mind. I've spoken with Jervis a little bit, Jervis Bush, and I've talked with some of the other people, you know, who are into emergent OD, which is kind of, if you talk to the people from emergent OD, it's kind of a predecessor to dialogic OD. And if you talk to the people from dialogic OD, it's kind of an offshoot. I mean, the field is full of people like that. Anyway, and they used to say, no, it's one or the other. And I can't believe that, like you. I mean, it's really, so I think there are times when you have to do things this way and other times when you have to do things that way. One of the big concerns I have, if you know, which methodology do you use, has to do with culture change. Okay. So culture is kind of, it's a nebulous kind of a thing. You know, there are people say you can go into a room and look at the artifacts and kind of determine what a culture is. And okay, fine. And there are others that say that it isn't, that culture comes from informal kind of talking with people, working with people, and learning by observing. And you become enculturated. Okay. And if you're trying to, from my perspective, if you're trying to change a culture or make a culture more open or more receptive or more whatever, that involves a whole lot of talking to people about what they believe and what they think. And one of the most difficult things you could ever do is change somebody's beliefs. They're ingrained from the time we're a little kid. We get certain beliefs that we hold forever. And trying to alter those, change those, open people to different ways of thinking about them, that's really, really hard. And if I'm going to work with a client on that topic, I will tell them how hard it is. And we'll do some activities on there just so they can see themselves how their mindset, their beliefs, pretty much cast in stone. And now we're going to change how people think in your organization. That's going to be difficult. And that's where, you know, we'll go toward a certain direction, but it'll be very idiosyncratic what we come up with.
Yeah, it's hard to get people to subscribe to something that they're not on board with, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So just want to go back to the seats at the table. We talked a lot about the OD practitioner, the trainers, the IT, HR, IO psychologists, but focusing on OD practitioners and their seat at the table, what would you say is the most important role that OD practitioners play today in an organization?
Effectively leading change.
Yeah.
The data, even if, you know, originally it was 73, then it's kind of like 50%. 50% success ratio is not very good, okay? And what I find, I find a lot of people are insecure about leading change. They come out of grad school, they maybe have a year or two of experience, and then all of a sudden they're responsible for leading change in a medium-sized company, and that whole imposter syndrome surfaces. And it's difficult to do. And, you know, I'm an old guy, I've been around for a long time. And so you're going to say, well, you have an old man's bias. And no, I a lot of people I work with are very young. I like staying up to date with what's going on, how young people think. But leading change is very, very difficult. And you have to have, confidence. I mean, think about it. What kind of moxie must somebody have to go into an organization? I'm going to change you. I'm going to fix you. I mean, that's ludicrous. You know?
Or I'm going to help, like, I'm going to guide you to adopt this tool that's something that you've never seen the value in before, right?
Right. I mean, it's like, you got to have a lot of moxie to make something, you know, to think that you can do that. And one of the tenets of the OD practitioner is humility. And to know that you can't do anything by yourself. You can't. You've got to have people on board, and you've got to help. I'm not a great psychometrician. As a matter of fact, I'm kind of lousy at it. But I have people who I can hire who, you know, I understand the theory. I understand what I can't do it, but I understand how it's supposed to work. And so I'll hire somebody who is a PhD psychometrician with 15, 20 years experience to work with me when I need that kind of skill. And that's the kind of, you can't do it by yourself. You're going to have to go and get somebody who can help you. Maybe there's somebody who's a better facilitator and better industry knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reflecting
on this quite a lot lately because 2 years ago, I helped the firm that I work with deploy an LXP, which is a learning experience platform similar to LMS, but a little bit more customized to the learner for those who are unfamiliar. And it was completely brand new to our company, and I had to really engage with so many stakeholders in the organization to not only build a foundation of content and knowledge that would sit and be housed within this LXP, but also find, you know, change champions and those who would be needing this solution to really take the charge and like learn how to use it and also spread the word, right? So you can't do it by yourself. Maybe as an OD practitioner, you are providing the container, the process, the, you know, you're facilitating the deployment of that change, but you cannot do it all by yourself. And also I think the consequence of trying to do it all by yourself is that you miss out on all of the really good opportunities that could come from input in that early stakeholder engagement when you are facilitating change. I'm rolling out a new solution for our company now, and I think about all of the individuals that are supporting the development of our career pathing solution. I don't know specifically what this individual does in their role, but they know. They're the experts, and so why not tap into that? So I think that's such a great point to make.
Yeah, I did something similar to that. I was working for a power company, and they had 180, they had several thousand employees, maybe 7,000 or 8,000. And they had 189 who were in senior positions who had been with the company for over 30 years and were going to retire. And these were senior scientists, and they were going to walk out of the door. 30 years of experience, and they were going to leave all of that knowledge that they had.
Yeah.
It was leaving. So they asked me, they said, Alan, can you capture that knowledge? And I go, I don't know. You know, let me think about it. And so we thought about it, and we decided to put together competency maps. And so I ended up interviewing 180, these all 189 of them, with jobs that I never heard of, with requirement, you know, experience and knowledge and expertise that I'd never heard of. And it took me a little over 2 years to complete the project. And I got to say, I did that like maybe 9 years ago, and they haven't changed it. Well, I'm thinking that, you know, I don't know, maybe the jobs haven't changed, but they really haven't. It's just too much work.
It is a lot of work to do competency mapping.
And so the idea was, you know, getting back to you, is that I couldn't do it, Mike. I didn't have anywhere near the expertise to do that. So I did have to rely on them. And then I'd write it and then send it to them and then wait for them to edit it and send it back. And, oh, geez. Yeah.
So just a little shift here for business leaders that might be listening. Describe the value OD brings to the workplace. I know we talked a little bit about the role that OD practitioners can bring around effective change leading, but what value does OD bring to the workplace? Maybe you can share an example or perhaps a story of when OD's value maybe was realized when you were doing like consulting.
The value is getting things to work smoothly. Okay. So let's take a process, number of steps in the process. If one of those steps doesn't work, the process stops at that point. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then beyond that point, people are dysfunctional and start blaming everybody else. That creates a negative culture because people are blaming everybody else. And it affects the productivity, it affects the quality. So when you have happy people doing things the way that is optimal, productivity goes up, quality goes up, sales go up, and that affects your bottom line, okay? It doesn't take you as long to do things, and you're not trying to figure out what's going wrong because somebody didn't do something they should have done, okay? So the idea of helping, and I call it organizational effectiveness. It's really not OD so much, but my job is to help organizations be more effective. Okay. And there are a lot of things that I do to help them. What was the other part of that question? The value. Yeah, can I give you an example?
Value.
Yeah. So you've probably heard about people who step into frontline supervision. How they have, you know, maybe especially in the union shop, because until they became a supervisor, they were labor. And when they became a supervisor, they were management, and labor and management clash. And I remember I'm working with this company. I won't mention the name because it's not a great story. But I remember the leader of the union, we were talking because, you know, they wanted me to change, to create a training program for frontline supervisors with the goal of changing the culture so that the frontline supervisors weren't jerks. Okay.
Essentially.
Because their thing is, well, management, labor sucks, management sucks. And so we're going to continue that, whatever. And so I figured if I'm going to do that, I'm going to have to get union support, because if I don't have the union support for this, it ain't going to work. So I'm meeting with the union president, and the union president was happy to meet with me and all this kind of stuff. And he goes, you know, I have one dream, Alan. And I go, oh, yeah, what's that? He says, one day I'm going to stop the name of the company. It's going to stop. All right, the company is like a Fortune 10, okay? So I'm not going to tell you where the company is, but it has a big unit. And he wants to strike one day to stop the whole thing. That's his dream. Okay. And I'm going, well, that's not shared by anybody else, but that's what this guy wanted to do. And I'm going, well, that's not productive. Okay. And so I had to kind of get his attitude changed and, you know, and so we were going to implement something called self-directed teams, and the teams were going to be able to do things, make their own decisions. And of course the union say, no, that's management's job. They make the decisions. And I'm going, and I'm talking to him. I go, who knows more about the job, doing the job than you? Does the supervisor know more about how to do X, Y, Z? Or does a guy who's doing XYZ know more? And he goes, of course, the guy doing XYZ. I said, of course. So why shouldn't XYZ, the guy doing XYZ, have a say in how XYZ is done instead of some guy somewhere else?
Mm-hmm.
And with that logic, I kind of got him up. He says, we can have a say in how the work is done. That's what I'm trying to get you to do. And so that was part of it. And then getting people to change their attitudes about labor and management, that, you know, that, look, we're trying to accomplish the same thing. And if we kind of work together on the things that are the most important to us, we'll do well. But if we keep hammer and tong at each other because we disagree or whatever it is, and it's more of a psyche thing than it is a let's make it work thing, it's never going to work. And so I did a number of things with the new people that came on that helped them begin to see how people respond to different kinds of leadership, how people respond to how they're treated. And we did a lot of, I focused primarily on their family and their children and how your children react based upon how you treat them, how you reacted based upon how your parent treated you. Think about how the people at the plant react based upon how they're treated. You know, it's all the same. It's how you're treated determines how you react. And oh my God, that took me 18 months. And
wow.
Yeah, it was the training program when we finally finished it was a 3-week residential training program. So frontline supervisors had to go to a hotel for a week, for 3 weeks, not consecutive. They went for a week through the break to the first part. Then they went back to work for 2 weeks. They came back. They tried the stuff that we introduced in that first session over 2 weeks. They came back and did it work? Did it not work? Whatever. And then we did another week, and then they went back to work for a month, and then they came back for another week. And, that last week, there's a whole lot of personal assessment, self-evaluation, self-awareness kind of stuff. And that last week, the last 2 days, I brought in executive management, the people who hired me to come in and do this, and I brought in the families. So the wives and the husbands and the children were there. And I still get emotional about it. There was this little girl who stood up and was holding her dad, around the waist, and she said, "Thank you for giving me my daddy back." And wives, and who said, "You saved our marriage." And wow. it was just powerful, powerful stuff. They continued, and I don't know if they're doing it now. It's quite a few years ago, but they did it for about 5 or 6 years, and they'd call me back every now and then to kind of help with the trainers. But the hardest part was teaching people how to facilitate, because a regular trainer just couldn't do it. You had to, and it went back to the days of T group and all that kind of stuff. So.
Talk about whole person approach. I mean, that's why I love our field so much, because yes, we help organizations around effectiveness, but we could change people's lives that extend beyond just the workplace, and it help with relationships and just so many other things. So thank you for sharing that story.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to do it.
So as OD becomes more widely known and more accepted, I mean, we're seeing that kind of, I see it at least, maybe you have a different opinion. I see OD kind of being more prominent. I see more jobs posted for OD and Iowa psychologists and org practitioners. What possibilities do you imagine are out there for those in the field?
I think the best way for an OD practitioner to start out is to get a job in training. And that's the route that I feel, and it's worked for me. But the reason that I think so is because a lot of the skills that you need as an OD practitioner, the skills, not the knowledge, but the skills, are congruent with a lot of the skills that an OD practitioner needs. And so being a trainer, a good trainer, can help you be a good OD practitioner. You right. still need the theory and all that stuff from OD, but some of those skills carry over. I think that's the easiest way, best way to get in. Some people get in through HR and they become, talent, whatever it is. They get in recruiting and That gets you nowhere. It really doesn't. I believe that a really good IOD practitioner needs to get into a job, whatever it is, look for problems, and they will see them, and then try to find ways to fix them.
Good.
You're not going to get permission. You just need to kind of find ways to fix them. And if you can fix these little problems that exist, people will come to you with more problems. And that's really what you want. You want people to come to you and say, hey, I've got this thing going on. Can you help me? And you say, yeah, sure. Let's take a look. Okay. Now, actually, I say, I don't know. Let's take a look. Because I don't know if I can help.
I don't know.
But I think what's going to happen, I think that there are so many changes going on right now. So many changes that if somebody can be good at it, and you need to have a process. It's not linear. It'll loop. Okay. But you need to have a process that you're comfortable with. And from the very first, when I started in this, my mentors, and I had some really great mentors, some of the early guys in the field, they said, Alan, trust your process and trust the people in the process. And I've done that. There have been times when I was kind of over my head, and I would go to my mentor and like, trust the process. And so I have a workshop that I offer. I think you may be aware of it. It's through the Peter Drucker Graduate School of Management. It's in OD and Change Leadership. And one of the tasks that participants have is to create their own change process. We review about 7 or 8 of them. There were maybe, I don't know how many, there are tons of them. But I say, okay, look, here are 7 or 8 that are most popular. Based upon what we've learned, based upon what you know from your experience, create your own process. I want you to have your own process, and I want you to be able to follow it. And that way, they're following something that they believe in, that they created. It's theirs. It's not somebody else's. Okay? And I think that once OD practitioners get to the point where they can do that, where they understand the process, and that, you know, they're going to go up and down, it's going to go left and right, but as long as you have this overarching process that's going to guide you, you'll be okay. And as people become more proficient and not, you know, that imposter syndrome kind of fades, they will move up in organizations and people will listen to them. I got called a lot in organizations because I fixed problems. I remember the performance management system, our performance appraisal system at this one big bank I was working with was terrible. I'll ask you a question. You've been performance appraisal, okay. So what's the largest scale? You know how they reach you from 1 to 5, 1 being terrible, 5 being wonderful. What's the largest scale that you've ever seen?
Well, it's interesting you bring this up because I was actually tasked to redesign our performance management system at our company as well. I have not seen personally over 5. Now in my research, I've seen it go up to 10. That's the highest.
You know what the highest I've seen?
What?
1,000.
What?
1,000.
How?
Okay. How? Okay.
I can't even imagine getting that adoption. From 1 to 1,000, what do you rate this on this criteria?
Okay. All right. So what happened was the people had, they called it a 3-point scale. Okay. But, it was like 1.005, 2.2783, because, you know, they were having a hard time differentiating between a 1 and a 2, a 2 and a 3, a 3 and a 4, 4 and a 5. So they put these decimal points, and instead of like 1.5, it was 1.25, and that's on the 1.258. It was 1,000-point scale.
Oh, my God.
Okay. And of course, it didn't work.
Really?
I wonder why.
It
didn't work. And I love performance appraisal systems because I think they're the easiest thing to fix, and all of them are messed up. Okay. They are. It's like, you know, they had the bell-shaped curve. Yeah, okay, so here's the thing. Who did you heard of pay for performance? Okay. What basically it says your pay is based upon your performance appraisal, right? Your rating. So if you get a 4, you get this percent increase. If you get a 3, you get this percent increase, right? Okay. That's a myth. That's a joke. There's nothing about it that is true. And the reason I say that, it's built upon a myth. And the myth is this. Okay. Somebody in finance at the beginning of the year, right now, maybe in the last 3 months, sat down and determined what the personnel budget would be for your company and what the overall percent of increase, the salary increase people would have. So they said, all right, we have a salary increase of 4% budgeted for this year. Okay? So if you're a manager, you've got, you know, you take everybody's salary, you got 4% of that, you got, you know, and that's what the scale is. So then then there are some companies that said you can only have so many 4s, so many 5s, so many 3s. Now your decision is, who do I screw? Because what happens is you can have everybody be really, really good. And you want to give them all the highest percentage, and you want to give them that 4% increase, you know. But then managers, well, you can't give everybody the same increase. That's just not right. You know, some people are better than others. And I'm going, what if they're not? You know, I've had really good people work for me. And I would tell them when they come, I said, my job is to give you as much money as I possibly can through our merit increase thing. Okay. So just trust me, I'm going to give you as much as I possibly can, but we got all these rules and hoops and everything else anyway. So I separate pay from performance appraisals.
And so then what do you align pay with then?
By basically how many projects did the people finish and what was the return on equity, return on investment. And so, you know, you can figure it out. It's based upon what are the contributions a person's making to the profitability of the organization. So I have to get involved with the people from finance to figure out how to calculate ROI and how, you know, this is what I'm thinking of. This person is an instructional designer. Okay. These are the 4 projects that they have. This is how we think the successful completion of these projects contributed to the bottom line of the organization. And then I'd have some guy with finance sit down and ask me a bunch of questions, and we'd sit down with the person and try to figure it out. It's a lot more complicated, but after you've done it 4 or 5 times, it's kind of easy.
Yeah.
It's just getting it started and so intimidating, people don't want to do it. But anyway, I think if you try to think about the last performance appraisal, how many people, do you have people reporting to you?
I have 1.
Okay, so that's easy. You got 1 person. What about somebody who has 10?
10, it's a lot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, can they really do a performance appraisal on 10 people? You know, monitor the person's performance over the year, write it up, you know, take a little notes, give little hints, give it, you know. No, they don't have time. Why? Because even with your 1 person, I'll ask you this question. Do you have more work than you can handle?
Yes, definitely.
Absolutely. So now imagine that you have 10 people and you already have more work than you can handle. How are you going to do it for 10 people?
Yeah, we work through a continuous performance model. So it's more about feedback and development and growth and continuous conversations around performance so that you can course correct, help individuals, tie them to where they need to grow and develop. And then that's I think where the power of performance management really sits is not necessarily in the pay for performance, but in the development and growth of individuals.
I agree with you 100%. My only caveat is if somebody has 10 direct reports, how well are they going to be able to do that with all the, with the workload that is already more than they can handle? You and I need to take this offline and have
a conversation about this.
So,
because I can already start thinking about like span of, you know, control and people should really be on a team. Because if you don't have enough time, then maybe you have too many people that you're managing. But without really planning, we've kind of moved from the past around OD, the present, and then I'd like to kind of take it to the future for just a few moments. Moving forward, OD has an opportunity to innovate and progress as a discipline. And so I'm curious, what in your opinion does the future of OD look like for both practitioners and organizations? Now, I know that's a huge question to ask, but you've kind of been through quite a few different evolutions of OD as we've talked about. So what are your thoughts around the future?
Okay, so I told you that I'm all into AI, artificial intelligence. Okay, so if you think about what does an OD practitioner do? Basically, ask questions and kind of put together, you know, look at the responses and kind of figure out, make sense out of the responses, right? Okay. You know who does that better than a person?
Computer.
and what's really interesting is that there are applications out there, artificial applications right now, that can analyze conversations. So, if, you know, they analyze this conversation between you and me. They can extract the key thoughts, key themes from your side of it, the key themes from my side of it, and kind of put together a summary of mine, a summary of yours, and a summary of ours. Okay? And kind of, if we program it to give us suggestions on how to move forward, it would do that. And computers do that a lot better than people, because people get hung up. There's this thing called processing content, okay? Process is what we're doing right now. It's like the conversation, the conversation. Content is what's being said. So process is, I'm on a video, you're on a video, you got a mic, I got a mic. That's a process. Content is all the things that are said. If you're facilitating, you got to pay attention to both. Okay. And the larger the group, the harder it is to do that. So I'm always team facilitating because I want to have enough people watching process so I can focus on content so that we can kind of bring it together. Well, AI does that very well. There's another thing that, have you seen the latest Avatar movie?
No, I haven't. I have to go see it.
Oh, okay. Go see it. It's amazing. Okay. But think about it. There, right now, you can go online and you can write a script and they will have an avatar who will read your script in a human voice with human pauses, with human body movement, and be able to do presentations without you. And you can't even tell they're not real.
So you're saying you can see AI technology taking the place of OD practitioners in the future, potentially?
Potentially.
Whoa.
I know. They can ask questions. They're just the computers. You can program them to like the eye movements, head gestures. They have software apps that interpret that. Okay, what does it mean? And the tone of voice, inflection, interpret that. What does that mean? Okay.
Okay.
And my thinking is computers will probably be able to do that better than humans. The only problem is people, you know, humans don't want to interact with something that's not lifelike. And that's why I suggested going to Avatar, because you'll see that in another 10 years, it's going to be very, very lifelike. And go ahead, I'm sorry.
So what space does that leave for OD practitioners then?
I think that, well, why am I into AI? Okay. I want to know what's coming. I want to be ahead of the curve, because somebody has got to do the programming. Somebody has got, you know, for example, when HR, IT was trying to take over HR, they were doing it from an IT perspective. HR was all over. No, you can't do it. You got to. And so they finally eventually worked together. Okay. And that's what's going to happen, I think, with AI and OD. They're going to have to work together. Look at how much training is done online now. Okay. What if a group could be hosted? You know, I'm not really big on the metaverse. Have you seen those artificial hosting? They're ugly, and you know, they're not very real. And I just think that we as OD practitioners are going to be aided in interpreting conversations, communications by artificial intelligence.
I know that the metaverse spaces that you're talking about are as lifelike or real right now, but they're working towards trying to make them really real.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering if that would open up OD practitioners to serve broader communities, or communities more in a more global sense, because the ability to interact in an alternative space than a physical space, which we can kind of do now through like Teams and Zoom, but that provides, I think, a little bit more nuances around nonverbal communication, maybe a little bit easier for that type of interpretation or different interpretation in a space. I don't know. There's a lot there. Do you have any other predictions?
I think the field of IO is going to have to reduce. It's too broad. It really is. I think that it's going to have to narrow its scope. And I know that people don't want to do that. I think the curriculum that are offered to universities, graduate schools. I talked to a lot of professors. Some friends of mine, people on my team, are professors who teach at universities. And they don't have a lot of practical experience. You know, some of them do. I mean, some of them are very, very senior, very highly qualified practitioners. And others dabble at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the curriculum has to be divided into theory and practicum.
Okay.
And I don't think enough time is spent really on practicum.
Okay.
I get people who come to me, people with PhDs, 5 or 6 years of experience, and they don't know how to do some of the things that I would think that they should be able to do.
Mm. It's that translation from theory to application that's kind of missing in essence.
And I think that whole practicum thing needs to be added to the curriculum of OD/IO practitioners. It gets short shrift, and it needs to be emphasized, I think. But you're talking to an old guy, right? I've been around the block, and you know, so many. I'm at the point where I think people are going to want to stop listening to me, because that was then, this is now, you know.
Well, one more question for you, because I'm not done listening to you. This is true to the concept of the podcast, Paradigm Shift. So I asked this question of all my guests. So what is the most recent paradigm shift that either you've experienced, whether it's related to this work or something outside of that, maybe on the horizon?
It has to do with my practice, my personal consulting practice. About 2 years ago, I decided I wanted to create an incubator, a consultant incubator. You've heard of business incubators? You have a place and people come in and they start their business. You have people help them. Well, I wanted to create a consultant incubator. That was my goal, to bring people in and teach them the business of consulting. And I thought, you know, maybe I'd get newbies and help them. That didn't work. I don't know if it's a generational thing or what, but people want to be told what to do. Tell me what you want me to do. Tell me what I should do. How do you want me to do it? What do you want? I think that's bad. And so my paradigm shift is, instead of telling people kind of how to do this or how to do that, I'm more towards asking people how to do this and how to do that, even though they may not have any idea at all. Maybe they never thought about it, but that's kind of where I am now. I think that people need to stop asking for the quick fix. The Google mentality. What's that? Oh, look it up in Google. And get back to thinking, you know, creating. I'm amazed at how many people can't create a simple thing like a organizational diagnosis instrument. You know, what should I ask? How do I do it? Oh my God, this is basic stuff, guys. But people don't know how to do it. So instead of telling people, my shift is to have people figure it out for themselves. I'll be there. I'll answer questions. But I'm not going to tell them.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. One of the most powerful concepts or techniques that I've seen help in supporting shifts from dependency thinking to more independent critical thinking has been, like you had said, inquiry, the power of inquiry, right? And asking powerful questions, really routed to coaching, but it really does support in putting the question back on the individual and helping them. I'm there, right? I'm there as a supporter to help you think through, but you need to also challenge your assumptions, come up with your own independent solutions or potential solutions for the problem. And so I've seen that help and support shifts when there are individuals who are more dependent on someone else or something else for an answer. So I really appreciate you sharing that.
Mm-hmm. I think there's people will, I'm interviewing some people who join our firm, and I ask them, you know, we get conversation around, if you have questions and I give you the answer, who does the thinking, you or me?
Uh-huh.
And I'm not interested. If I'm doing your thinking, then you become hands. And I don't want hands in my company. I want thinkers in my company. So, you know, it's kind of where I come from.
Powerful. Thank you. Thank you so much for that, but also for walking us through the past, the present, and the future of OD. And I'm really excited to share this with listeners and to get feedback. And thank you so much. I appreciate all of your time, energy, and expertise.
It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to talking with you about the performance management system.
Performance management. You got it.
Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to leave a review, rate, and subscribe wherever you're listening. If you know a business leader in practice or friend who you think would be interested in this episode, please consider sharing it with them. I am so grateful for your support. For more updates, you can follow us at Paradigm Shifts Podcast on Instagram. See you on the next episode.